Okay, I want to speak about something that has to do with the parshios last week's and all the parshios coming up till Vayikra in general, and then something specific to next week's Sedra. If there's time, even more than one thing. The book of Shmos is called Sefer HaGeula. It's the book of redemption, Exodus. Now, I understand why the first four Sedras are in that book, because they have to do with the Exodus. Shmos, Bo'era, Bo, Bishalach, which ends or contains within it the splitting of the Red Sea, that completed the redemption. So the redemption wasn't completed until the Egyptians drowned, and then Shira Chadosha, Shibchu Geulim, the Jews were redeemed. I also understand why the next Sedra is in Sefer HaGeula, Yisro, because the physical redemption wasn't complete until the spiritual redemption took place. And that spiritual redemption was the giving of the Torah. And that's why the holidays of Pesach and Shavuos are connected with Sfiras HaOmer, to connect the physical redemption with the spiritual redemption. Ein lecha ben chorin al mishosik b'Torah. But after that, the rest of the Sedras in Sefer HaGeula don't seem to fit. Mishpatim, last week's Sedra, is very similar to the Sedra of Kedoshim in Vayikra, or the Sedra of Kiseitze in Devarim. It could very well have been in Vayikra or Devarim. Why did it have to be in Sefer HaGeula? Mishpatim is basically an array of basically civil law. And after that, Truma, Tetzava, Kisisa, Vayakil, Pekudei, are the Sedras that predominantly have to do with the building of the Mishkan. Now, the next book is called Toras Kohanim, Vayikra. It's the laws of the Kohanim, the laws of sacrifices and so on. Now, I would say that the place for the building of the Mishkan is in Vayikra. It's the beginning of the laws of the Kohanim. In order to have sacrifices and all the other things that go on in the Mishkan, you have to have a Mishkan. So why weren't these Sedras the beginning of Toras Kohanim and not the end of Sefer HaGeula? That is the question. So the Ramban answers the second question, and utilizing that Ramban will answer the first one too. The Ramban says that Geula means retaining regaining the Mila, the greatness that the Avos had. Geula means to redeem your potential. And until the Jewish people regained their original greatness, they didn't redeem their full potential. What was that original greatness? That God's Shechina, His presence, devolved upon the houses, the tents of the Avos, constantly and consistently. They had that tremendous connection, attachment to God on a regular basis. Until the Jewish people regained that level, they weren't fully redeemed. When did they redeem? When did they reach that level? When the Shechina devolved on the Mishkan. And then, Vishachanti Bisocham. And then I'll dwell amongst them in the heart of every Jew. So God's presence devolved on the houses of the Jews in the Midbar when the Mishkan was finished. And that was the completion of the Geula. And therefore the Sedras of Truma, Tetzava, Kisisa, Vayakal, Pekudei, which deal with the construction of the Mishkan, and finally God's presence devolving in the Mishkan, on the Mishkan, culminates with them. That's when the book of redemption culminates. But it still doesn't answer what in the world Mishpatim is doing in there. I understand everything till Yisro and everything from Truma till the end of Shmos. Why Mishpatim? So let me tell you what I think. I have quite a few answers tonight. We'll give just one. And that's the following. Mishpatim are basically civil law. Okay, civil law, as opposed to chukim, which is super rational. Civil law is more rational laws. Don't murder, don't steal, and so on. Things that a person could have come on his own, even if God didn't command us, rationally we'd know. People don't steal, people don't murder, whatever. As opposed to super-rational laws, chukim, like kashrus, and think laws like that, that are super-rational. That if the Torah didn't tell us, we wouldn't come to it on our own. The pasuk says, Magid, Devor, V'Yaakov, Chukov, U'Mishpotov, V'Yisrael. The Rabban Shalom said over his chukim and mishpotim to the Jewish people, Lo osochein l'chol goy. He didn't do that to every nation. U'Mishpotim bal yidom halaluka. And he didn't make known his mishpotim to the nations of the world. Now, I would say that it would make more sense if it said, V'Chukov, bal yidom halaluka. The Rabban Shalom didn't make known to the nations of the world the chukim, the super-rational laws. But the rational laws the Goyim know. So why does it say Mishpatim Bal Yidol? The rational laws the God didn't make known to the nations of the world. The answer is that even though the chukim are supposedly rational laws, and the Mishpatim are rational laws, and the chukim are super-rational, every chok has some rationale to it. We have a lot of Torah written on the understanding of why paraduma is metame tahorim and metayer tameim, which is a chok. It makes people who are pure impure and the impure pure. There's a lot of Torah written to make that understandable. But bottom line, in the end, it's a chok. Even though there are rationales to a chok, but predominantly it's something beyond rationale. Mishpatim predominantly are rational, but bottom line, they're all chukim. They're all things beyond rationale. The areas, black and white, are rational. The gray areas are not rational at all. For instance, euthanasia. That's not young people in Asia. That's mercy killing. Okay? Euthanasia is murder. I would never want to debate anyone as to the rationality of prohibiting mercy killing. Because rationally, I could come up with a nice argument of why it's okay to do. So, is it rational not to mercy kill? No. It's a chok. Torah said you can't do it. Abortion. I wouldn't want to debate a pro-abortion person purely from a rational standpoint. Because there is a lot of rationale to say that abortion should be okay. It's only not okay because the Torah says not okay. Whenever it's not okay. So all mishpatim are also chukim. Except predominantly there's a rationale. And all chukim have a mishpat to them. There's some rationale. But predominantly they're not rational. So in the end, all Torah laws boil down to the fact that they're osur or mutter or a mitzvah because God said, not because of rationale. Because God said. They're all chukim. Not only that, but our civil law is very different than the non-Jew civil law. Civil law by a non-Jew, and they have a mitzvah to make civil law, to have a social justice system. Right? It's one of their mitzvahs, according to some Rishonim. Dinim. To make a social justice system. But the entire basis of their social justice system is to have a functioning society. Laws that basically create a functioning society. It shouldn't be anarchy. And they are basically laws between man and man. They have nothing to do with between man and God. But by us, there is no clear line of demarcation between laws that are between man and man and man and God. All laws that seem to be between man and man have aspects between man and God. And all laws that are between man and God have aspects between man and man. The clear distinction between them is not a clear distinction. I'll give you examples in a second. And that is borne out in the following. And therefore, all our laws in the Torah, whether they're civil law or whether their religious law, is all religious law. There's no distinction between religious law and civil law. It's all God mandated, and all is there to bring us closer to God, not only to create a functioning society. The Telzer Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Mordechai Katz, that's all, was once asked by an irreligious person who wanted to attack religious Jews. And he said, I don't understand these religious Jews, Rabbi. These religious Jews who cheat and lie and deal dishonestly in business. So the Telzer Rosh Hashiva, Reb Motl Katz, answered him the following way. He said, you know, I have the same problem. I don't understand these religious Jews who desecrate the Shabbos, eat on Yom Kippur, and eat Chazer. So he said, wait a second, Rabbi. Those aren't religious people. He said, well, neither were the first ones. Why did you assume that people who lie, cheat, and deal dishonestly, they're religious, except they do all these things? Then these people are also religious. Elamai, neither of them are religious. People are not religious only because they daven and they eat kosher, but it's a whole Torah. And if you don't do this part, you're just as much not religious if you don't do the other part. So if you understand that these people aren't religious, then why are you telling me you don't understand religious Jews who do this? They're not religious. We don't have a religion that has religious laws and social laws. Between man and man, that's social laws. And between man and God is religion. Everything has a connection between man and God. Together, there's no separation. I'll give you examples. Let's take a religious law. Kashrus. Kashrus can't get more religious than that. Right? Kashrus. Torah says, don't eat a treifa. Now, we use treif as a universal term to mean anything that's not kosher. But it's not really that case. Treifa is a specific kind of non-kosher food. What is it? An animal that had one of 18 different kinds of maladies that would cause its death within 12 months, that you slaughtered, kosher, shechita, and then you found that it had one of these maladies, you can't eat that animal. That's called a treifa. Now, the Torah says sometimes, or usually, those maladies come by the animal being mauled by a wild animal. For instance, you have a sheep, and a wolf comes and mauls the animal. Doesn't kill it. It's alive. But it dug its claws into its chest, and it made a hole in its lung. So after you slaughtered the sheep, you found it has a hole in its lung. It's a treifa. Can't eat it. So the Torah says, what do you do with this treifa? Give it to the dogs. Throw it to the dogs. So we know the Medrash. Why do we throw it to the dogs? To reward the dogs who didn't bark by the slaying of the firstborn, by Makos Bechoros. The dogs didn't bark, and the Vilna Gaon explains what was the big deal, so they didn't bark. Because the Gemara says in Bava Kamma that whenever Eliyahu HaNavi is around, the dogs sense it, and they bark out of joy. And when the Malach HaMavis is around, the dogs sense it, and they bark and whine. Had the dogs barked the night of Makos Bechoros, it would have intimated that the Malach HaMavis was around. And would have taken away from the nace that God smote the firstborn of the Egyptians. So they didn't say a word. They didn't bark. And then everybody knew the Malach HaMavis isn't around, so it must be God who's doing it. That was what the Medrash says. What's the simple meaning? It says the Daz Zakenu Mibali Atosus, why do you throw this sheep that you can't eat to the dogs? Why do you give the meat to the dogs? Says the Daz Zakenu, because normally flocks are led and guarded by dogs, sheep dogs. And you have now a sheep in your flock that you can't eat. Why don't you sow some gratitude to the dog for doing his job and protecting the sheep? You can't eat this sheep in the flock. Give it to the dog who did his job of protecting the sheep. There's only one problem. You know why you can't eat that sheep? Because the dog didn't do his job. Because had he done his job, then the wolf wouldn't have attacked the sheep. Says the Daz Zakenim, so what? So one time he didn't do his job. But does that erase all the times that he did do his job? You still owe him a debt of gratitude for the times that he did do a good job. So give him the sheep. That's the Daz Zakenim. What can we learn from that? That has to do with human interpersonal relationships. You know people, let's forget about ourselves, but you know people who had good relationships with two families, good friends for years, and they did each other favors And then all of a sudden, one of the families did something not nice to the other family. What usually happens? The family writes them off completely. Nothing to do with them anymore. Why? Why does one bad thing erase years of good things? You don't treat a dog like that, says the Daz Zakenu Mibali Atosus. How do you treat a human being? So here is a super rational law of kashrus being Adam Lamakom, God, law, religious law, but its implications are interpersonal relationships between man and man. How about the other way around? I'll give you one example. The example is Geneva and Gazela, seemingly a very simple civil law. Don't steal. But you know there's a difference. If somebody comes and snatches your purse in broad daylight, right, grabs it from you and runs, and then they catch you, what does he have to pay you? The contents of your purse, the purse, whatever, what's it called, whatever he stole, he has to pay back. But if that same person sneaks into your house at night and steals your purse, and then they catch him, he has to pay double, kafel. The Gemara says one idea, why is the guy who snatched your purse only responsible to pay back one time, and the guy who snuck into your house at night has to pay back double? Because the guy who snatched your purse in the daytime is not afraid of you, and he's not afraid of God. But the guy who broke into your house at night is afraid of you, because he had to sneak in. But he's not afraid of God. Somebody who has the capacity to fear, and fears people, but doesn't fear God, is much worse than the person who doesn't fear anybody. So therefore, this guy, we give a knas, we give him a fine, he has to pay back double. Now, we're talking about civil law. They both stole the thing from you. What difference does it make if the guy has Yerushalayim? He doesn't have Yerushalayim. What does his Yerushalayim have to do with civil law? The answer is, very simply, there is no such thing as civil law. It's all religious laws. And everything is taken into consideration. Both your laws and his Yerushalayim. The godly part, the interpersonal part. There's no clear line of demarcation. They're all the same. And therefore, before you can have God's presence permeate every aspect of life, as it was by the Avos, you have to permeate every aspect of life with God's presence. And therefore, before you have Mishpatim, which tells me that the godly part of the Torah and the interpersonal part of the Torah are the same. God is there not only when you're in shul, in a Beis Medrash, he's there when you're in your office. And it's the same God. And that's why the Sanhedrin was situated opposite the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach represents getting close to God spiritually, sacrifices. The Sanhedrin took care of the civil law of the Jewish people. There's no difference between them. The Sanhedrin is opposite the Mizbeach is opposite the Sanhedrin. There's no line of demarcation between civil law and godly law. It's all godly, it's all religious. When you understand that, then you can build a Mishkan and eventually have God's presence permeate your entire existence. If you don't understand that, then the Mishkan is not going to bring God's presence into every aspect of your life. And until God's presence was in every aspect of their life, they weren't redeemed completely. And therefore, Parshas Mishpatim, as well as all the other Sedras, till the completion of the Mishkan, are in the book of redemption. Okay. Any questions on that? If not, we'll go on to the next thing. Next thing is next week's Sedra. Let me tell you another thing that we can learn from what seems to be a very religious law, something concrete. The Torah says like this, that the Ark, the Aron HaKodesh, was made of a sandwich. It was made of wood that was sandwiched between gold. Gold on the inside, gold on the outside, and wood on the and wood in the middle. And the rabbis say that that symbolized the following, that a Talmud Chacham, who's representative of the repository of the Torah, he contains the Torah, he's like the Aron, should be Tocho Kibaro. His inside should be like his outside. He should be gold on the outside, gold on the inside. He shouldn't be a faker, what's it called, you know, and on the outside make a show, and on the inside he's not gold. Or the opposite, he shouldn't be on the inside and not show on the outside what he really is. He should be inside and outside gold. So ask the Dazikanim, another Dazikanim. He asks, wouldn't it have been better if the Ark was solid gold? Then that lesson would have been much stronger. A Talmud Chacham should be solid gold. Right? Much better than just gold on the inside, gold on the outside. Solid gold, through and through. Says the Dazikanim, there are other answers to this question. Says the Das HaKeinim that, let me tell you one something, I think Rav Shlomo Shofar Hirsch says it. Beautiful idea, why it's not solid gold. Gold is malleable. Wood is not. Gold is not alive. Wood is. You need a balance between the life and the lifeless, and the thing that can be shaped and the thing that is rigid. A Talmud Chacham certain times has to be rigid like wood. You can't, sometimes he has to be able to be shaped and adapt and accommodate. The Iker is the life that's in the middle. The rest is all facade. Okay, in any case, Dazer Kanim says a much more simple answer. He says, yes, most certainly it would have been a much better lesson if the Aron was solid gold, but it would have been too heavy to carry. An Aron of those dimensions, solid gold, would have been impossible for human beings to carry. Therefore, it had to be predominantly wood and only a thin facade of gold, and then it could be carried. He says, the Aron, there was a nace that happened, that the Aron carried the people that carried it. So it didn't have to be carried. It was buoyant to the point where it carried the people who carried it. We don't rely on miracles. It had to be carryable naturally. Maybe the miracle wouldn't happen. It had to be able to be carried naturally. That's a dasikane, very simple dasikane. Let me tell you what I learned from that. I'll tell you a story. I had a girl in my kehila in Miami. She was about 16 years old. She was balas tshuva. She became religious through NCSY. And she lived with her mother. And I think her father wasn't even Jewish, and he's out of the scene completely. So I only knew her mother and her. Her mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Zero. Zero. So everything this girl came home with was like new to her. Kashrus and Shabbos and Tznius and the mother's, you know, the mother's mind was like, you know, reeling from all of this. But she was a good mother. And she went along with everything this girl wants. She made the house kosher. And she bought her a whole new wardrobe of Tzniistic clothing. And she, didn't, was Michal Shabbos in her presence. They sat and ate a Shabbos meal or whatever, and she cooked everything before Shabbos, just for the sake of this daughter. But the mother constantly, you know, the daughter constantly found out new things, and the mother would come to me, is this really necessary? I never heard of this before, whatever. One day the mother comes to me, and I see she's really upset. She says, tell me, Rabbi, are you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. She said, then why don't you eat kosher? I looked at her, what's coming? What happened was like this. In Miami at the time, there was one glatt kosher butcher shop where the meat was brought in from Denver, okay? And it was brought in already, shechted, trebered, everything, and the butcher just, you know, they cut it up and sold it. And, however, the shechita was not what they call chassidish shechita. It was good, kosher, glatt kosher shechita, 100% okay. And all the rabbonim okayed it, except some of the Hasidic Rabbonim prefer to have Hasidic Shechita. What's Hasidic Shechita? It has nothing to do so much with halacha. Certain kepedas that are okay halachically, but they, for instance, I'll give you an example of one of the things, not any all the things. They're makbid that any shochet who shechs has to have a beard. Nowhere in the Torah or in Maseches Chulin does it say that a shochet without a beard, right, his shechita is no good. But it's a hither. They want shochet with beards. So even if a shochet shaves in a permissible way, they don't accept that. They want a shochet with a beard. Okay, that's chassidish shechita. Okay. So some of the people arrange that they should bring in meat from another place, which cost double what this meat cost. You couldn't, it was only a small group of people who wanted it, so you had to order an entire four quarters of an animal at a time, get a special freezer to keep it in, and every few months they would bring in this meat. You'd have to pay double the amount, travel about 50, 60 miles round trip to pick it up from a central pickup place, and store it in your special freezer. Okay. And this is for people who wanted Hasidic Shechita. This girl got wind of the fact that this meat, you know, some people don't want to use the other meat and only this meat. She decided she can't eat the other meat anymore. It's not kosher. She has to have this meat. So she told her mother, from now on, we don't go to the butcher shop anymore where the rabbi buys his meat. We have to go and pick up meat every few months. You have to buy a freezer, and you're going to have to pay double for the meat than it costs now. So the mother came to me. She said, "I understand, Rabbi. You say you're an Orthodox rabbi. You don't eat kosher. My daughter has to get meat that you eat the other meat, and she won't eat that because not kosher. How come you eat not kosher meat?" So I said, "I'll take care of this." I called the girl in and I told her the following. I said, "You know, if you were married and you decided that you wanted to do something extra special and only eat this special Hasidish Shechita meat, and you wanted to spend double for it, and you wanted to make the trip of 60 miles to pick it up, and you wanted to buy the freezer and go to all this extra expense and bother, I'd say Matov Manoyim, Yashar Koach to you. But you're not married. And you know who's going to have to pay for this meat? Your mother. You know who's going to have to go and pick it up? Your mother. You know who's going to have that freezer? Your mother. Okay? Let me tell you. It says that the Aron HaKodesh would have been much better if it was solid gold. But since it would have been too heavy to carry, they made it not solid gold. What do you learn from that? That sometimes it's kedai not to be solid gold if the people who have to carry you are not going to be able to carry you. If somebody else has to carry you, then maybe you shouldn't be solid gold. Same thing over here. It's your mother who has to do the carrying over here. You want to be solid gold, but you're going to be too heavy for your mother to carry, then maybe you shouldn't be solid gold. Maybe you should buy in the regular butcher shop. It's 100% okay, just not solid gold. If it would be a halacha, right, so it'd be a different story. But here it was a hither. I said, when you'll get married and you'll do the carrying, you want to carry yourself solid gold, gesunter hay. Don't make somebody else have to carry you solid gold. Better you should be only a facade of gold on the inside, a little bit of wood. That's sufficient if somebody else has to carry you. So here again is a halacha that seems to be totally separate from anything interpersonal, and yet there are lessons that you can learn in everyday life from even the way that the Aron HaKodesh was made. Okay, now let's go back to that. I'll tell you something else. It says that the Aron should be tocho kibara. The inside should be like the outside. Now what does that imply? Which comes first, the inside or the outside? If the inside has to be like the outside, it seems to imply that first you have the outside, and then you make the inside fit the outside. Right? Adapt to the outside. But is that the way that Yiddishkeit is? First you worry about the outside, first you worry about how you look on the outside, and then you try to make the inside compatible to that. Wouldn't it be better to say that the outside should be like the inside? First you start with the inside, the internal things. That's the main thing. And then you try to see to it that you look on the outside the same way you are on the inside. Why does it say the opposite way? The answer is very simple, because that's the way things work in this world. Right? That's all the Torah, is doing external things in order to get to internal ideas. As the Chinuch says, the chitzonios is ma'orer, the pnimios. Maisim, actions, motions create emotions. Now you need to work on the outside, on the externals, to be able to get to the inside. You can't, it's hard to get your inside working, your neshama working. You have to do it through the body. Simchas yontif. How do you get happy on yontif? You eat and you drink. You do external things and that makes you happy. Once had a woman, also Miami. She was slowly becoming more and more observant. She was an observant woman, but her standards of kashrus were very lax. Her standards of Shabbos were very lax. And her standards of tznius, how she dressed, were very lax. So she started with kashrus, and she decided she's only going to use good hechsherim, you know, that's impeccable. She re-kashered her house, and she really was medaktik in kashrus. Then she worked on Shabbos. She really upgraded her Shabbos. She learned the laws of Shabbos. She had her husband learn, taught her children, and the house became really Shomer Shabbos, not just, you know, wishy-washy. Finally, I decided that it was time for her to graduate to the next thing, tznius, which was difficult for her, to start dressing, especially Miami, properly. So I told her, I said, you know, I think you're ready already for the next area of improvement, to start dressing modestly according to the laws of the Torah. Now in Miami that was very good. At that time, the people who dressed properly, right? In Miami it was a mile of people dressed at all. So what's it called? Dressing properly was like only for the Rebbetzins, the Klei Kodesh, the Rabbonim's wives, the Mechanchim's wives. But everybody else, it wore short sleeves and so on. So I told her, I think you're ready to start dressing like you should. She said, Rabbi, I don't want to be a hypocrite. And I don't feel inside yet like a Rebbetzin. I don't want to dress where people look at me like a Rebbetzin, because I'll be a hypocrite. I said, very nice. I said, you know what you can be compared to? The following. Imagine somebody coming to shul on Simchas Torah. And he says, you know what? I'm not really happy. If I get up and dance, I'm going to be a hypocrite. So I'm not going to dance until I sit here and contemplate being happy. And as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. The guy will sit there till Tisha B'Av. How do you get happy? Dance. You're not a hypocrite. You want to be happy with the Torah. You can't get happy by just sitting here and contemplating happiness. The way to be happy is to go through the motions. You'll dance, you'll get happy, and it will seep into the inside. I said, you know how you get to feel tzanua? By dressing tzanua. But you'll never become tzanua if you dress not modestly. You'll get to feel modest. You want to get to that. You're not a hypocrite. You're not trying to put on a show. You're trying to go through the motions, so eventually you'll feel that. That's not hypocrisy. That's the way the world works. So you always need the external to be ma'orer the internal. That's how you get to it. Motions are the things that generate emotions. There's only one problem. So that's how the rabbis describe tocho kibaro. The inside should be like the outside. You start with the outside, and you make the inside accommodate itself to the outside. There's only one problem. The Torah doesn't say that. That's how the rabbis describe the oral. But the Torah seems to say just the opposite. What does the Torah say? V'tzipisa oso zahav tahar. You should cover it with gold. Mi bias, from the inside. Ubachutz, and the outside. Titzapenu. Should you cover it with gold? So which is the Torah mentioned first? The inside. Then the outside. So why? So why did the rabbis change it around and describe it the opposite way? That the outside should be, that the inside should be like the outside, when the Torah first says the inside and then the outside. I was thinking, no, Torah doesn't say that. Torah says the following. V'tzipisa oso zahav tahar. If it would only say that, I would say you have to cover it with gold on the outside. Then the Torah says, mibayis. And now, but do it on the inside. And then michutz, and then on the outside. Just three coverings. First, the outside. Then the inside. Then the outside again. So you start with the outside. That's just what the rabbi said. And then you get to the inside. And then you go again on the outside. How does that work? It's exactly how the Gemara describes how the Aron was made. Moshe Rabbeinu made three boxes. Small one, medium-sized one, large one. The large one and the small one were of gold, and the medium-sized one was of wood. What did he do? He took the wooden box and put it into the medium-sized wooden box and put it into the big gold box. So now the aron, the wooden aron, was covered with gold on the outside. Then he took the little gold box and put it inside the wooden box. Now the aron was covered on the inside. So first you covered the outside, then the inside. What was left to do? The rim. If you looked down, you saw a sandwich. Gold, wood, gold. Now you had to cover the rim with gold, so the outside of the top should also be gold covered. That's again on the outside. So it was outside, inside, and again on the outside. So now we have something to explain. So we already understand why you start with the outside, because motions, externals, generate internals. Okay? But why then do you need, and now that reaches the inside. Now what's the idea then of the outside again? So I think it means the following. Let's go back to the person on Simchas Torah. Okay? He comes to shul, he's not happy. But he wants to get happy. He wants to be happy with the Torah. So he starts dancing. And tak, it works. He gets into a really good mood, and he feels now good and happy with the Torah. Now it's seeped in to his inside. What would you say now? Should he stop dancing? Because he doesn't need to dance anymore. Dancing is just to get you happy. Now he's happy. No. He continues dancing. Why? Because there's another aspect to expressing the inner feelings outwardly. It's not only that the outward motions generate the feelings, but the outward motions manifest the feelings. There's a Ramban in his Perush on Aseres HaDibros. It's a separate work. It's not his Perush in Chumash. It's a separate work, the Ramban on Aseres HaDibros. In there, he explains the following pasuk. The Sfasemis brings this Ramban many times. The pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, Mato'iru u'mato'oru esa'ahava ad she'techpot. Do not arouse. If you have a great feeling of love for God, tremendous feeling of love, do not arouse it and leave it just floating in the air. Ad she'techpot, until you put it into some concrete chefetz. Express it concretely. Don't leave it ethereal. Don't leave it just floating in the air. Why? Because the expression of very spiritual, emotional feelings is much stronger when you express it physically than when you leave it totally spiritual. And therefore, there's two functions to the physical. One is to generate the spiritual, and then to express the spiritual. Once you've generated, now express it in a physical way. And Rav Moshe Cordoviero, the Kabbalist, says that the neshamos in Gan Eden look forward and anxiously to Tchias HaMeisim, to the resurrection of the dead, when those neshamos will go back into a physical body, like we wait for Mashiach. Why? Because functioning in a physical realm is greater than being a spiritual neshama in Gan Eden. Because in order for the feelings to be strong, they have to be expressed physically. Very interesting idea. And that could explain the following Ramban. Everybody asked a question on this Ramban. There's an argument between the Rambam and the Ramban. What is the order of history? We all know this is this world. Okay, that's accepted. That's the most, probably the hardest one to understand. But that we know, we're in this world. Then there's going to be Yemos HaMashiach. That's also this world, just the ideal of this world. That's Yemos HaMashiach. Then there's Olam Haba and Tchias HaMeisim. What are they? The Rambam, with a mem, Maimonides says, they're two different things. There'll come a time, Olam Haba, he says, is a totally spiritual world that exists already. When a person dies, his neshama goes to Olam Haba. Why is it called Olam Haba? Not because it's the world yet to come. It's the world that comes after you die. It exists simultaneous to this world. It's a spiritual world. That's called Olam Haba. There'll come a time when all the people who died and their neshamas are in Olam Haba will then have Tchias HaMeisim. They'll come back for a period of time back to this world. And then they'll leave their bodies and go back to that spiritual world, and that will be the end of history, Olam Haba. Totally spiritual world, that's the end, the culmination, totally spiritual. The Tchias HaMeisim will be a period of time, for whatever reason, we're not going to discuss now why that Tchias HaMeisim is important. But for whatever reason, there's going to be a time when people will come back into the body for a limited amount of time. Something will be accomplished then, and then they'll go back to Olam Haba. Okay. The Ramban argues on the Rambam. And he says that Olam Haba and Tchias HaMeisim are the same thing. Tchias HaMeisim will be in the world to come that doesn't exist now. The Ramban also agrees that there's a spiritual world that already exists, that comes after death, but that's not called Olam Haba. That's called Gan Eden, Gehenom, not Olam Haba. Olam Haba will be when all those souls that deserve it will come back into the body And that will be the world to come. It'll be a new world refashioned to accommodate eternal bodies and souls. And even though it says that in Olam Haba there's no eating and drinking, it doesn't mean that we don't have a body. It means you won't need to eat and drink. Just like Moshe Rabbeinu was 40 days on Har Sinai without eating and drinking, it's possible to have a body that doesn't need to eat and drink, that doesn't need to carry out any of the physical necessities of life. But we'll have an eternal body, body and soul together, and that's the world to come. Tchiyas HaMeisim and Olam Haba are the final stage, and they are synonymous, simultaneous. So they ask on this Ramban, why in the world would God put the neshama back into a body if you don't need a body? You're not eating, drinking, you're not doing anything that the body has to do, so what do you need a body for? What's the purpose of this body? Why not just leave the person as a neshama? But based on what we said, there's two purposes to the body. In this world, the body initiates what the neshama can do. By eating and drinking, you create the ability for the neshama to exist in this world. Because in a healthy body, you can have a healthy neshama. If you starve your body, the neshama can't exist in this world. So you need a body for the neshama to exist. And the body initiates and arouses the neshama to various things by getting first aroused physically. And then you need the body to express those things physically. Two ends. In Olam Haba, Tchiyas HaMeisim, you won't need the body to preserve the neshama or to arouse the neshama. It'll happen by itself. The neshama will be the main thing. But you'll need the body for the neshama to express itself. The neshama will need the body to express itself more than just spiritually, but in a physical way. Like we said, that the expression in a physical way is much greater than the expression just in a spiritual way. That's the purpose of Tchiyas HaMeisim. Therefore, that's how it works. First, you have the outside in this world, which initiates and arouses the inside, and then once you have the inside, you express it again externally in order to give it some concrete physical mamoshes, right? That it's much more significant. We have a few more minutes, so just put this into explaining a medrash. The medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was told to build the Mishkan, so God told him to first build the Mishkan, the plant, and then the kelim, the vessels. When he told it to Bezalel, he switched it around. He said, first build the vessels, then the plant, then the Mishkan itself. Bezalel said, can't be. God couldn't have told you to make the vessels first and then the Mishkan, because that's not the way of the world. If I make my furniture first, where am I going to put it? First you build the house, then you make the furniture. Because if you build the furniture first, where are you going to put it? So Moshe said, you know what? That's what God said. You were in the shadow of God, and you knew. Bezalel, that's why he's called Bezalel. Few things. First of all, why did Moshe Rabbeinu switch it around? There's only two possibilities, and both of them are impossible. Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. If that's possible, then what does that say about the rest of the Torah? Or Moshe Rabbeinu bedavka fooled Bezalel. What does he have the right to fool Bezalel? God told him something, he switches it around. Moshe Rabbeinu had that right to play around with the Torah. So what's going on over here? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu switch it around? One question. Second question. If Bezalel already understood what Moshe did, seemingly, then why was he called Bezalel? Usually, tzel, shadow, is associated with doubt. Right? Tzilo shel sofek, a shadow of a doubt. And light is clarity. So if Bezalel got it clear, he should have been called Orkel, not Bezalel. You weren't in the shadow of God, you were in the light of God. You knew it. What was the shadow? Shadow is always with doubt. I want to say like this, Bekitzer. Moshe Rabbeinu was given this command in this week's Sedra before the sin of the golden calf. Before the sin of the golden calf, we didn't need a Mishkan to arouse us to God's presence. God's presence was everywhere. So what did you need the Mishkan for? That when you were aroused to God's presence everywhere in the world, You came to the Mishkan to use the Kalim and to express it. Like we said, you needed the physical thing in the Mishkan to express God's, the ideas that you got everywhere. You didn't need it to get to those feelings because you got them anywhere in the world. You didn't need a Mishkan for that. So the main thing of the Mishkan would have been the vessels, not the area. Had God told Moshe Rabbeinu, but after the sin of the golden calf, you needed the Mishkan first to arouse you to God's presence and then to express it. But first you needed to be aroused, because you couldn't be aroused everywhere because the people went on a much lower level because of the sin of the golden calf. Had God told Moshe Rabbeinu clearly, first make the plant and then the kalim, which would have meant you first need to arouse yourself to God's presence in the Mishkan, Moshe would have said, what's going on? And he would have realized that there's probably going to be a sin that's going to diminish what things exist now. And God couldn't let Moshe Rabbeinu even have a hint that there's going to be a sin, because if people know there's going to be a sin, it interferes with free choice. God's knowledge doesn't interfere with free choice, but people's knowledge does. So God couldn't intimate to Moshe. So he made it unclear. He put it in a shadow. And he made Moshe Rabbeinu think that he meant the Kalim first and then the Mishkan, which fit as things were before the sin of the golden calf. But it was a facade. It was a smokescreen that Moshe shouldn't know what really is going to be, because God knew there was going to be a sin, and he knew eventually first is going to come the Mishkan and then the Kalim. When Moshe told it to Bezalel, it was after the sin of the golden calf. So Moshe was still under the impression of what God told him, that he thought God told him in the beginning. But God on purpose made it unclear. So it would seem that Moshe could understand it, first the Kalim, then the Mishkan. When he said it to Bezalel, he said, that's not the way things are. People need the Mishkan first to arouse them to God's presence. Then, when they're aroused, they can express it through the Kalim. Must be that God told you the other, but he masked it because he didn't want you to know there was going to be a sin. That's what Moshe said. Bezalel, you understood the shadow that God cast of doubt over me to make me think the other way, in order that I shouldn't know there's going to be a sin of the golden calf. But you're right, that's really what God meant, except he didn't want me to understand it then. Now I understand it. That's why he's called Bezalel. So the Mishkan has both of those purposes. It arouses you to God's presence with the physical plant, and then once you're aroused, use the Kalim to express those feelings that you have. Before the sin of the golden calf, it wouldn't have been like that. You'd be aroused anywhere in the world. You wouldn't have to come to the Mishkan. And then the Mishkan was predominantly just to express those feelings in a concrete way through the Kalim of the Mikdash, and not to be aroused to them, that you didn't need a Mishkan for.